Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's Sunday, December 22nd, 2013, and welcome to episode 6643.
What?
No, Carrington, it's episode 64 of the Retro Computing Roundtable. City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find... The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. I'm Earl Evans, a man without a title, an enigma wrapped in a mystery. I don't even know who I am. Joining me, as always, is Carrington. Carrington, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, fine. You can call me Carrington Carrington.
I'd intend to. The man's so nice, they named him twice. And then there was Paul. Paul, how are you, my friend?
I'm rushing toward the holiday season much too quickly, but I'm fine.
The time does go by quick. It's funny, my daughter just turned 15, and we do this little thing where we have this puzzle that has the 25 days countdown to Christmas, and they get a piece of candy and stuff like a little treat every day. And she was going, man, the time just flies as you get older. And I'm thinking, you're 15.
Yeah, but 15 in base what?
Wait, true. Wait until you get my age. The time, like you age 5 years per year. So, yep, the holidays do go by quickly, and I'm looking forward to what's under the tree, because I had some cute little goodies on my list for this year, and it might include some microcontroller stuff, or some stepper motor stuff, robotics, you know. I will let you guys know when the new year comes.
You're a big nerd.
Hey, who are you calling big?
I'm not judging, I'm just saying.
So, I want to tell everybody, this is a particularly exciting show. Not only is it the last RCR you're going to have to put up with in 2013, but we've got a prize contest at the end. And even though you're going to be bored to tears with us, you have to wait until the end of the episode to find out what the prize is and how you might have a chance at winning it. Ha ha! But without further ado, I will start, because I'm the host today, and I get to talk about whatever I want. Today, my choice is, what is your favorite modern-day add-on for vintage computers, and why? And I will say this, before I kick it over to you guys, you cannot both choose the CFFA 3000.
Well, I'm not going to, so there.
All right, Carrington, well, great. Then let's start with you.
Okay, so I may be cheating when I answer this question, and I'll leave it up to you guys to judge. And if you don't like my choice, then I'm picking the CFFA 3000, so there. So I started thinking, and I actually walked around my place when I read this in the show notes, that this is what I have to come up with, and I'm looking at my old computers, and I don't have a lot of those, and trying to think, well, what do I attach to those? And what's a bit of hardware that I use? And there's not that much, but then I kind of cast my mind a little wider and thought a little sneakier. And I started thinking, well, I guess a lot depends on how we define modern and how we define retro. Because really my favorite, at one point, modern add-on that enabled retro stuff is itself now retro. So it's sort of like a two-layer thing. But the item itself is modern compared to what it does, because of all the hardware, or even really software, of all the add-ons I have for retro computers, my favorite is my Apple IIe card. And I've got that inside my Quadra 605, which is essentially the same as a Macintosh LC475. Yeah. And what it does is turn that relatively modern computer into an Apple IIe. And I adore it. It's wonderfully fun. It's before I had a CFFA card or any networking ways. It was an amazing way to get disk images in a form that I could play them on the Apple II. It's a great way to play Apple II games and take screenshots and get them over to the modern Mac, because it'll just, you know, save a file. And then I've got it on the Macintosh side that I can then use. I can network it because I use a SCSI adapter, because the one port is used up by the 2E card. And I adore it, and I've always adored it. So I think of it as a retro add-on to a modern computer. It's just that I've had it so long now that the modern, quote-unquote modern computer sin has now itself become retro. So that's my choice.
I don't think that's cheating at all. And I've heard you talk about that before, and that does sound like just a wonderful combination of technology.
Yeah, it's amazing. Although the computer it's running in is what, from 1993, I think. So it's itself
20 years itself.
Exactly.
Right.
Very, very retro. But the add-on is enabling an even more retro event. So that's my choice. That's my favorite bit of hardware kit that is a modern day / retro thing.
Excellently done.
Thank you.
Paul, can you top that?
Oh, well, can I use the CFFA 3000 now?
Yes, you can, because Carrington didn't pick it.
I could at least say the CFFA 3000 in an Apple III. Maybe that's...
Sneaky.
No, actually, I was thinking about this a little bit, and it does seem like the categories are many of these categories are some kind of disk replacement. That because those are the things that are failing. Sometime later, I think I want to talk about the power supplies that are also failing. Mm. But one thing that occurred to me when Carrington was talking about this was the one bit of kind of like middleware like that is the serial adapter, USB to serial adapters. That has made a lot possible. To be able to actually connect using the ADT Pro program to connect with Apple IIs and things like that. But
now, I've never tried that through one of those serial adapters. Does that work without any issue?
Well, once you get it working, yes. I think there are different kinds of different converters that you can get. But
yes,
I fortunately just had some lying around at the point when I needed them. But it's because I think I used them to connect a Palm Pilot to... I think it was a Trio to my cell phone, so I could use email on the train. but from long ago. But I think probably still the reigning king is the CFFA 3000 in my own operations.
So I'd like to dig a little bit more into this, because all I've ever heard is glowing praise for the CFFA 3000, and I don't have one myself, and I trust the impressions of my fellow retro enthusiasts, so I want to find out, you know, speaking as an Apple neophyte, what is it about the CFFA 3000 that just makes it so darn good? And both of you could chime in on this.
Okay, Carrington, you want to start?
Well, sure. Yeah, for me, I mean... It's just it's so darn easy. I mean, and we should. I'd like to swing back eventually to talk about, because they're actually, I believe, we're in a golden age of this sort of thing. And I actually can think of tons of other little current hardware-y thingies, though mostly Apple focused because that's what I'm on. But there's right now between the Raspberry Pi, like so many things coming out and the Raspberry stuff. And anyway, lots of stuff. But for the CFFA, what's just so nice about it is it's so seamless and so fast, especially the modern version that lets you plug in a little USB thumb drive, load it up with disk images, and then you got this little remote control thing on the outside that just lets you switch between them. And it just makes it so convenient, because the internet is just filled with disk images. And for me as an avid gamer, it's an amazing way to just load up a ton of disk images. I'm not really concerned with having a hard drive full of stuff. I just want to have, pretend I put a floppy in, now I want to play Choplifter. Pretend I put a different floppy in, now I want to play one of the Ultima games. And for somebody like me, it enables that with a very fast setup and then just completely seamless operation. I don't even have to think about it. I don't even really change the disk much. I load it up with what I want, and I now have an Apple II that just is loaded with these things on tap. And so it just it enables, you know, real-world Apple II use with just a massive library of software without having to swap around with disks, because all the disks in the world seem to be dying. So for me, that's the big deal. And the fact that it was so fast and so seamless and so easy to use is what made it really appealing.
I think for me, one of the things that really kind of sets it apart from what it what it could have been is the sort of the onboard firmware that it has. It has a quite a sophisticated menu-driven system that lets you format things and image disks and various things that it's very configurable, and it's quite friendly. I think that makes a lot of the difference between it and other kinds of similar sorts of flash memory type add-ons you can have for the Apple. And I also very much like the fact that it's small enough to fit in the Apple III. It's unfortunately the positioning of the USB port is such that you can't use the USB port in an Apple III, but it's still, you know, it can simulate a profile hard drive and no need to turn on the actual very loud one. So.
Well, if you even have one that works, because the profile hard drive for the Apple III is even a more rare component than the III itself, isn't it?
I think, well, they were also, yes, it's rare. It was shared with other machines at the time, so it was somewhat common with the Lisa, and you could run them on the Apple II as well, so it wasn't exclusively III focused. But
oh, okay.
I was going to just move away from Apple for just a moment to say that there are a lot of these flash type drive simulators for other machines as well, emulators I should say.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't tried it. It's sitting tantalizingly on my shelf, but I have something called a NanoPeb for TI-99/4A, which is I don't know if you know the 99/4A system, but it you could get a peripheral expansion box, which is this
big
gigantic
gray box.
Thing. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And so the NanoPeb sort of plugs into that same spot, but gives you memory and ports and I think it might be SD card access. Maybe it's compact flash card, but
awesome.
So yeah, it's I'm actually quite looking forward to trying that. I'm not sure that I would use the 99/4A for much if I didn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
But that sort of makes it possible to sort of do something with the machine.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to chime in and also recommend for the BBC Micro that I have very, very little experience with. But from everything I've read, something over at RetroClinic.com, they make something called a data center. And it's a similar sort of thing. Like it's something it's a little card. It goes inside your BBC Micro and it lets you have disk access. But it does a lot of things that similar products for other retro computers don't seem to do or don't seem to do as well. For instance, it has these USB ports and it'll act not only as something where you can plug in a thumb drive and you can plug in thumb drives of any size. You can even plug in like hard drives of like 2 terabytes. It'll say, okay, no problem. Like a lot of these things are very limited in the sizes they can access. This says, I'm a modern computer, whatever, throw anything at me you want. So that's really nice. But it'll also act as a USB host. So the same card enables you to plug your BBC Micro over into like a PC and access it that way and dump things on it. So it's acting both as a host and as just a normal USB interface. And it does something else, as I remember thinking as well, like that was really impressive that it just works over the bus cable. Anyway, that's, from what I've heard, is the best of them for the BBC Micro because it does USB. It lets you use USB peripherals with it as well. So you can use a keyboard and a mouse and all those things on your BBC Micro, as well as accessing drives and as well as acting as an IDE patch and like all those things. So really, really impressive. And I'll point out that it's going to come up again later when we start talking about the things I'm recommending people to buy. So
oh, cool.
That's why I know about this. I was researching it for my auction choice. That will come up again, so we'll talk about it more. And the other one I'd want to give a shout out to, Option 8, to bring it back to the Apple II, which I often want to do. Because over there is where, you know, all those retro connector shields, like the keyboard shield and the joystick shield that are letting you interface between modern items and the Apple IIs. And that's also the... they did that, the Apple IIe Y cable replacement, which, because it's the cable that's hard to come by. And so I think that's over at Tyndall.com. Tyndall.com. So you can find all the various retro connector things. And I think, like, that's the kind of stuff I was talking about, where I believe, like, now versus even, like, 2 or 3 years ago, there's such a surfeit of these modern devices. And I think stuff like the Raspberry Pi, and particularly Arduino, have really helped give birth to such a wide range of modern little hardware adapters and devices that can connect and interface with retro computers.
It is a total golden age, as you said. It's a shut up and take my money mm-hmm. age. And I'm going to talk about something similar for the Commodore. Go figure. This device is called a Flyer Internet Modem. And it's actually a hybrid device. It's both a disk drive replacement or an add-on disk drive in that it emulates a Commodore disk drive of varying types, 1541, 1571, 1581. It can handle all three of those image types. And it has onboard flash memory to store multiple images that you can cycle through with a push button. But also, it's an internet modem. It connects up to the Commodore via what's called the IEC bus, and that is a daisy chain peripheral bus on the Commodore, similar to the SIO bus on the Atari, and that kind of thing. And with this, you can speak to it using standard Commodore DOS commands and the protocol and connect up to the internet. You can make TCP connections. You can access cloud servers where you have disk images stored and download them to the local storage on this device. You can use it for things like Telnet, IRC, and there are actual software packages written to let you use it for those things that you can download. And it's just a beautiful device. I mean, I know the guy who built this thing, and he puts a lot of engineering effort and care into these devices. And I've got one. I just love it. I mean, you do practically anything with a Commodore to get on the internet and to store your disk images locally. So it's beautiful. Flyer Internet Modem.
Nice.
So that's my choice. And I, you know, we'll try and have links for all of these things that we talked about, or as many as we can, because it's just, it's beautiful stuff. And now I'm going to move us forward. Thanks, you guys. That was a great conversation on that. You took my mediocre topic and turned it into a winner. Carrington, tell us about the Christmas Bites Festival.
I can't go, because I'm in the wrong country, but...
Oh, before you tell us, though, I have to ask, did you go to the T-Pugs World of Commodore?
I forgot about it. And I'm so sad, because I just thought of it recently, and I was like, hold on, when was that? And looked in my calendar. I was like, why didn't I set this as an alert? So I missed it.
I mean, I was thinking you'd have to go incognito. But...
No, I would have gone fully cognito. I was going to go in my Apple shirt and interview people about why they're settling for a lesser computer next year, man. I've put an alert already for end of November of next year to remind me to look around and find the date of this event and go to it. So, oh yes, next year I'm coming. I'm so sad that I missed it. So, alas.
Nice. But anyway, sorry, the Christmas Bites Festival.
So that is going to be taking place at the National Museum of Computing, and I am a big fan of the National Museum of Computing, but alas, I am in the wrong country to go. but if, however, you are out in the UK, and it seems like a really fun thing to do this event. It's located at Bletchley Park, and of course, we've talked about the National Museum of Computing before, and they're going to be having, between Christmas and New Year's, so if you're a fan of Boxing Day, and looking for something to do, particularly something with kids, they're having something called the Christmas Bites Festival. And it's just a couple of pounds, and there'll be Lego Mindstorm stuff, but there's also going to be retro computers set up and retro computing games for kids to play. There's going to be at least one, and maybe more, vintage stand-up arcade games. It's going to be a Space Invaders game there. There's going to be Pac-Man stuff and a Raspberry Pi doing a Minecraft setting, and there's going to be interactive computer music things. So all with a sort of a retro flavor. So if you're looking for something to do and you're in or around Bletchley Park, that's something that's very kid-friendly, retro computer-oriented event coming up between Christmas and New Year's. So it's running between it's from the 27th to the 31st of December of this year, and it'll be from noon to 4 each of those days.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yes, it makes me wish I was over there. It sounds awesome.
Yeah, I thought it sounded like fun. And kind of in keeping with that, there was, just as another little short bite to throw out there, James Houston, who is a fellow in Scotland, an artist in Scotland, has put together and put up a video called A Computer's Carol. And it's essentially the song Carol of the Bells, but re-sung by vintage Macintosh, a Commodore 64, a ZX Spectrum Plus One, and a Sega Mega Drive, all using voice synthesis programs on all of those to sing out new lyrics that he has written for that song. I listened to it, found I couldn't understand a word. and it's not the Scottish accent. It's one of those things. In fact, I read an article recently about, or maybe it was a tweet. I read something recently where somebody was saying how if you didn't grow up listening to the sound of, you know, very bad synthesized voice in toys, you'll probably never be able to understand them. Well, I couldn't understand this anyway. So we'll have a link in the show notes so people can sort of listen to the song. Maybe we'll insert a snippet into the edit of the music here. And it's a fun video to watch too, more than just listen to the music. And if you go to the site we'll link to, it has all the lyrics. So if you, like me, can't understand a word in this Christmas carol, then you'll be able to just read along and imagine that you can understand the voice synthesis coming out of a ZX Spectrum Plus One.
Awesome.
Just something to get you in the Christmas mood.
I will go over, take a look at that, and yes, I will probably have to read the lyrics as well.
Yeah.
And as always, yes, hats off to Tien Mok. Those guys do a top-notch job over there. Isn't there also a Bletchley Park podcast?
Is there?
I think
I've
listened to
that.
Several episodes of it. I can't remember exactly what the origin is of it, but they had really good information about some of the restoration efforts that they were doing there at Bletchley Park. So
I will seek it out.
Yes, we'll get more information on that. You got to listen to that.
If it does exist, there'll be a link in the show notes.
And
if it doesn't
Paul,
exist.
Well,
email
I know
Earl.
It exists because I've heard it, unless it was in
Can
you know,
other people hear
some
it?
Sort of oxygen deprived fantasy, but. I just don't remember exactly what it's called, so
cool.
We'll go seek it out. But speaking of things I wish I could have gone to but didn't, Paul, what have you got for us?
Well, it's actually just a short note. The Homebrew Computer Club there was a reunion of the original Homebrew Computer Club recently, and I think we talked about it last time, maybe even the time before it was mentioned. But
we did.
There's a video now. They've released the it's an hour and a half of various speakers. So some of whom I knew and some of whom I didn't. But it's interesting listening to kind of just the. I don't know, reminiscing and discussion of the olden days and, you know, directions that computing could have gone but didn't.
Hmm. I was so hoping that they would take some video of that event for the majority of us who couldn't actually be there. That's great.
But anyway, so that's all. I watched it. I'd recommend it. The pacing is uneven, but that's okay.
Well, it doesn't have to be Joe Pro. You know, continuing on with this category of things that I'd like to go to but can't because they're too far away, there are some vintage computer meetups starting over in Switzerland. And if you go to vintagebytes.ch, and if you understand German, you can get information on this. The first meeting is January 15th, 2014. They're going to be covering homebrewing and the N8 VEM, the Z80, or as Carrington would say, Z80-based homebrew computer.
God save the queen.
So Oscar actually sent me some information on this. Thank you, Oscar. And I will read some of this information from an English translation of the flyer. They say, we'll kick off our first monthly meeting with a short presentation on how to build your own Z80 computer using two of the home-built CPM computers designed by the N8 VEM project as examples.
Cool.
It's going to be at the Hackerspace Luzern on 15 January 2014 at 2000 hours. And they also talk about some of the topics that they'll have in subsequent months, and it sounds like a great group. Yay!
It's
more
a cool
vintage
thing.
Stuff.
The N8 VEM, which is a single board computer, is super cool. We talked about it in an earlier episode ages ago, but I'll make sure we have a link to the Homebrews project site in this episode's show notes, so you don't have to go digging in the past, because it's really fascinating and great to read about.
Mm-hmm. And John Mark also sent me some information about the Glenside Color Computer Club, the Coco Club, in Carpentersville, Illinois. They have what looks like a quarterly newsletter, and in their autumn 2013 edition, we made the cut. We are actually mentioned as one of the many, and it's interesting because on Floppy Days, yesterday, I had the opportunity to be chatting with Randy of the Floppy Days podcast, and we were talking joyously about how many stinking retro computer podcasts there are at this point. Not just retro computing, but retro gaming. It is a cornucopia out there. And in this listing on the editor's clipboard, we are one of the proudly listed podcasts.
Oh, very nice.
So thank you, Coco Club. And thank you for continuing to spread the love and enthusiasm of the Radio Shack color computer. And that's my bit. Now, Carrington is going to talk about a zombie raising a CDC 6500 from the dead, or as we would say, an undead computer.
Well, this is being billed as Paul Allen's engineers. They're attempting the toughest computer restoration yet. So this is the newest arrival over at the Living Computer Museum. Basically, all my things this are going to be about museum stuff.
I know some of these guys. I'm sure they can do it. Yeah.
Well, this is over in Seattle. Yes, exactly. So they have a CDC, a Controlled Data Corporation 6500. So big iron, one of the first supercomputers. So one of those ones that it says it comes with three giant bays, each of which has its own refrigeration system. That's what I call a real computer, baby. So exciting. It's one of those ones that has like a telephone part built into it. Like there's photos of this that are just glorious and wonderful with big knobs and dials and phone systems. It just, oh, just love it. The bigger the computer, the better, I say. So they are trying to bring this back to life. And so we have a link over to GeekWire, which is where I found out about it from, because I found that this write-up is better than what is currently on the Living Computer Museum site itself. They just sort of make a mention that they have it, but they don't really have a lot. And here there's a whole video about it that shows the inside of it. And what I really liked about this, and I thought this was wonderful, is they talk about, a fellow named Michaels talks about in this article that they have to be careful about authenticity. And I like this. He says, it's so easy to emulate various functions of a system. You could easily replace one of these with a Raspberry Pi and nobody could tell the difference. But we want to adhere to authenticity. People have to know that this thing really is what it was. And that's what I think what differentiates like the museum approach to like my own approach, where I'm like, yeah, as long as it looks like the right thing, I don't really care what's inside. I just want it to work.
Hack it till it works, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so doing wonderful stuff here. This is a really cool-looking computer. If you like big iron, this is one of my favorite ones. It's awesome. There's a great video on the site, so I'll have a link to that. And that led me over to something else that's actually on the vintage or on the Living Computer Museum site, which is super cool. They have a job listing. In fact, they have two job listings. And right now, they are looking for a vintage system software developer and a vintage hardware restoration engineer. But the software developer sounds the coolest. So basically, if this computer, they're specifically looking for somebody who can work on the CDC 6500 supercomputer. So if you want to program on one, really, there's a job opening at the moment for it. How cool is that?
I wish I was qualified for that.
I am not qualified at all, other than to sit there and look at it and go, look at that, so cool.
Wow, that'd actually be fun to work up there with those guys.
Yep. Now, there's a hardware restoration engineer job open as well. They're looking for somebody who can work on PDP-10 and on this supercomputer as well, and also just a variety of vintage computer systems. They say they maintain 60 different types of vintage systems, from mainframes to personal computers. And they're looking for basically a restoration engineer who can sort of look up the right parts, I guess, and make sure they're kept running. And so both jobs look super cool. I am not qualified for either of them, but we'll have a link in the show notes in case you want to get a job that I wish I could have.
Very cool. Yeah, they're serious about preserving the original nature of this equipment. They have a PDP-7 there that needed replacing of some of the power supply components with modern equipment because the existing power supplies had gone kablooey. But when they did this replacement, they used some custom hardware so that they could mount the new power supplies without disturbing the mounting bracket mechanism and et cetera of the old power supplies. So it could be, if you desired, restored to its original configuration.
But see, that's what makes them a museum. Like that respect for the original bolt matters. And I think it's important work, and I'm really glad they're doing it.
Me too. And I think they do it well.
Yeah.
So, Paul, you had something to mention about old notebooks?
Yeah, so this came to light fairly recently. I think it's a recent interview, and it's brought me into kind of like a world that I didn't know before, so I'm not sure. It's quite possible that it is well known, but there's a website and a series of videos by the Spoonie Experiment. But what caught my attention particularly was there was a recent interview with Richard Garriott, who is responsible for Ultima, and it's in several parts. It basically was, I think, a tour of the offices or something. Richard Garriott has started this new, now what is it called? Something of the Avatar, right? He's got a kickstarted project that is working on a new kind of Ultima-related project. But this set of interviews was basically him going through some of the museum-like stuff he's got in his offices. He's got an Apple II there. And the thing that I actually found the most interesting was him sitting down and going through these binders that he's got of his original drawings from trying to work out the bitmapped graphics and then translate that into binary so it could be translated into hex so it could be poked into memory in BASIC. Ooh. And he saved all this stuff, and so you can
original
see
original artifacts.
Yeah, he seemed to be very he kept everything, and it's in perfect condition. He's got paper tapes from the original I forget exactly, I think teletype, some kind of teletype machine that he wrote Dungeons and Dragons on, but it was quite interesting. I wish that the video were better, and that you could see the notebooks better. But he does go through it in quite a bit of detail, and I think the thing that sort of surprised me about it when I was watching it was just that he's still in it. He's still there. His head. He speaks Apple II perfectly, and it's actually in sharp contrast to the person behind the camera who can't differentiate between many many things that are sort of being discussed there. They're all sort of old, ancient, ugly history. But if you can sort of hear past the interviewer, it's really quite interesting to listen to just all of his recollections of writing a Calibeth and marketing it and making the maps and all these things. So it's really worth watching.
Very good. And that's on YouTube? We'll have a link to that.
Yeah, I think it's actually, you can get to it. SpoonieExperiment.com is, I think, the place where it originated, but there is a YouTube link that you can go to directly.
Cool.
All right. And I'm going to make a shameless plug for Floppy Days, Randy's podcast that I really enjoy, and that he was perhaps foolish enough to invite me to be on an episode with him.
And you made him regret it.
Well, he's not done regretting it, actually. But he and I, it's a part two where we're talking about the TRS-80 Model 1. Excellent subject. But what's interesting is, mentioned on that episode is a new book on the history of the color computer.
Ooh.
The book is called Coco, The Colorful History of Tandy's Underdog Computer, and it just came out, and I hadn't heard about this book. From the Amazon page, they say, Coco, The Colorful History of Tandy's Underdog Computer is the first book to document the complete history of the Tandy Color Computer, a popular 8-bit PC series from the 1980s that competed against the era's biggest names, including the Apple II, IBM PC, and Commodore 64. So, I don't know anything about this book. I don't know if it's good, bad, or indifferent. But I do know it's brand new, and that it covers the history of the Coco, which is something that is completely opaque to me. I have, like zero knowledge about how that computer line came to be. So, I would be very interested in reading this book.
I'm going to, in fact, I just added it to my cart on because I had a Coco. I had the original Coco, the silver one. I think it was the 48K version or something. It wasn't the smallest version. I think it came as low as 16K. So I had something else, but I had one of those, and it was the computer that I didn't do that much on it. I really liked the BASIC on it. I thought the Radio Shack BASIC or the Tandy BASIC was really good. And I eventually ended up using it for a short time as sort of a dedicated CompuServe machine. So that's how dated that was. So I had, I think, a CompuServe cartridge that would go in the side, and
I was going to say, it had a CompuServe client?
I think it was a cartridge.
Wow.
I'm going to have to really think back, but I know I was on CompuServe on a Coco, my silver and black Coco, and I'm pretty sure it was a cartridge that plugged in the side, and then I'd use my it was an acoustic coupler modem. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 300 baht of awesome, baby. And I'm pretty sure for a while that was my way that I got on CompuServe with my crazy, you know, that long number with a comma, then another number that would be your username. And oh, how terrible. That was it. I remember as well, that was the first time my parents got a massive phone bill because of something I had done.
Yes.
Because I was paying, it was a long distance call. There was like no Canadian. So I was paying long. And back then it was like long distance. Well, it's $10 a minute because we do it by hand or something, like whatever. The stuff the phone companies got away with. So it was a long distance call. Plus I was paying for the, like the per minute charge to be on CompuServe, and my parents put their foot down, and then I got heavily into freaking, and my parents never got a phone number, no. Phone bill like that again, but just the one time.
Are you past the statute of limitation?
Come and get me. So yeah, but that one time, and I remember my dad saying, "What is this?" I'm like, I promise, Dad, that'll never happen again, and really, that's my excuse.
Awesome. Yeah, and CompuServe wasn't cheap just all by itself.
Yeah.
Their per-hour charges were not cheap, but that was that was really sporty for the day, getting on CompuServe and getting the latest computer news and, you know, all this kind of pre-internet kind of stuff.
I liked my Coco a lot. I just hated the joystick.
What model of Coco did you have?
It was the color computer, like this, the first one. So on the cover of this book, it's got the white one, which I think is the second model. I don't know the Coco very well at all. But I've always intended to go to the CCC, the Coco Fest, that takes place every year, the 23rd. What is it? The annual last Coco Fest every year. And I've always wanted to go because it looks like a cool event. And it's only over in Lombard, Illinois. So I could totally make it there. Maybe I'll go this summer. But I had the first Coco, which was the silver looking one. And what I liked about the... what I forgot about it was, because it's a big computer, but it's plastic, and it weighs like nothing. So when you see it, when you see a picture of it, it looks like this big metal thing. And when you pick it up, you're like, is this empty? there's like nothing inside it. It's such a light computer for its size. That's the thing that I remember from when I got my hands on one again later. But it was the silver one I had. I think it was the 48K version. I'm not really sure. I just had a few cartridges. I do remember that it had the worst joystick I've ever had, ever. The flopping around little panties. Silver joystick thing? Useless. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't auto-center, I think, right?
Just sort of fall. Eh, I'm here, like, with no feedback. It was terrible joystick. But I played a game that was one of our listeners will know. It was some sort of maze game that was like a bug in a maze, and there was part of it that was zoomed in, and then part of it that was not zoomed in the background. It was a big maze, you know, and I really liked that game. So I played that game on the Coco with a terrible joystick. That's my strongest memory of the Coco. So there you go.
I think there was, I think there was some, unfortunately my memory of this is very poor, and actually recently acquired too, but there was some model that looked just like the color computer one, but was pretty much a dedicated terminal. I'm not sure if it predated it, or if they used, or if they just sort of used spare color computer one, cases. They look almost exactly the same, except they do nothing except communicate.
I think that there was a Videotex. Remember Videotex?
Yeah,
I think it was a Videotex terminal that came out in the early 80s that looked just like the Coco, but had like a slight difference in the keyboard, I think, or something. But from a distance, it looked like the exact same thing.
Yeah, I think that is indeed exactly it. By the way, I think that that game sounds a lot like a game that was called Dung Beetles on the Apple II.
Oh, I think yes, on the Apple II. It's that same game, but I don't think it was called Dung Beetles. Nice.
Yeah.
Good memory.
All right, thanks.
You know, I was trying to look here. It seems to me like there was a place where you could get one of the Coco clones brand new still.
Really?
And it seemed like it was in California. Doggone it, I can't find it here.
But I want one.
Yeah, I know. I will try and find this place to see if it still exists.
If our show notes don't have that link, Earl let us all down.
Yeah, it'll be my fault.
Head over to rcrpodcast.com after the show and see if Earl has let us down.
But it's been my fault so often that I'm kind of getting numb. Speaking of which, I have to talk about gifts that you can buy me. And
it's the season.
It is. So if you want to do this, my choice for this episode is a men's barcode scan UPC code cloth necktie that you can get from Amazon. And this is for those occasions where you have to dress up, but you want to make the statement that I'm a geek and I'm dressing up under duress. So you get one of these neckties and you can show that not only are you dressing up under duress, but that you are more than just a number. Well, no, maybe you are just a number. I think one of the funniest things about this necktie is the product itself has a UPC code.
It should be its own UPC code.
That would be funny, wouldn't it? I can't zoom in close enough to see. But this looked like it would also work with a variety of clothing choices because it is like a UPC code, black and white. So it would go, you know, it goes with your finest suit, and there you go.
And would work at Kansas Fest.
You can be scanned with the best of them. Nice. Resistance is futile.
Probably shouldn't wear it to the, FedEx. The FedEx distribution center where you will be shipped away.
Yes.
When you want to dive through the cash register at a grocery store, slip and slide style, it's the perfect tie to wear.
That's bizarre that it beeped, they would say, as you slid across the...
Or you just say the word beep when you dive through. That works too. So I should remind people that over at rcrpodcast.com, of course, we have our gift guide. There's a retro computing gift guide. This will be added after the show. We already have 68 different items there. So this will become item number 69. So there's lots of different choices. So if you're looking for something, let's be honest here, just like on the latest Antec where they said, for the most part, this is for the listener to buy themselves because most of us will appeal to us more than the people in our lives. But you might be able to convince the people in your life to buy you something and you can just point them at our gift guide. So there's 69 different choices of items that would appeal to the retro computing lover over at rcrpodcast.com/gift guide.
Indeed. And it actually is a great reference. And the funny thing is I've gone to it on a handful of occasions myself to reference the stuff that we've done.
Sir, is this your computer?
Yeah.
It's unusually thin, sir. Please open it. Is this large area the screen, sir?
Yeah.
Sir, the screen is abnormally large and unusually bright.
I know.
Not the usual computer now, is it, sir?
No, it's not.
A supervisor to Station 12.
It's a showstopper. The Hynode Ultra 2000 with Intel Pentium processor with MMX technology from Digital.
So let's talk about eBay and the wasteland that eBay can be. But we wade through that wasteland with our hip boots, and we find the best and the brightest for you, our dear listener. Carrington, I will start it off with you. What can we buy on eBay that is noteworthy?
Well, I, for this time, am picking a... Acorn BBC Model B. And I have no idea if this is a good value or not. It seems to be priced at more than you could get a decent BBC Model B for. And I don't know the BBC that well, so I don't know if this is any good. But I noticed, I was wondering, like, why is this £195 when typically if you've got like a Model B on eBay, it might go for £50 or £100 or something, like, what, even good condition. What's up? Because this comes with a bunch of books and guides, and that seemed nice and seems in good shape. But I was wondering, what's the difference here? But there's one of the photos shows it opened up, and inside is that data connect or data center that we were talking about at the top of the show. So this is that thing that gives you USB host and USB slave capability and a full megabyte of RAM that can be used for the filing system and stuff. It gives you the ability to use external mice and keyboard and that sort of thing. It gives you the ability to plug in a hard drive or a thumb drive and get access to floppy disks. So it's basically got the CFFA 3000, all that happening plus more, already installed and working inside this BBC mic Model B. So if you're looking for a BBC and you want to get one all tricked out, just here it is, ready to go, looking nice, working fine, fully tested, and has all this extra functionality, yes, it's £200, but you get it all in one go. And so it seemed pretty cool, and it's the thing that introduced me to this whole idea of the data center, which looks totally sweet. So I'll have a link to the data center site as well, and then this option, this auction is gives you an all-in-one option if you want to just kick off a BBC Model B collection in one shot.
Yeah, that's very cool. I have to say I've been... I think it's probably the same seller has had a few of this sort of thing, and I've been sort of watching them for a year and a half or something, thinking, oh, maybe this time, maybe I will get it. But one of the things that are also featured on some of these. I don't know if this one is a power supply conversion. So you can buy them already capable to run in North America.
That's exciting. I wonder if they... Because I've been looking to add to the computer that appeals to me the most outside of the Apple II at the moment is the ZX Spectrum. I've got this thing for the ZX Spectrum. I got this whole thing. I got to break off a piece of that ZX Spectrum action. And I don't know why, but the last few months, it's really appealed to me because I keep seeing auctions for hundreds of cassettes of games that were never translated over to anything in North America. And I'm just dying to play these things. And I like the colors, the bright, vibrant colors on the Spectrum. It just really appeals to me. But I've been reading about like what I'm going to have to do to get that thing to work in North America and using, like, I'm going to have to step up the power. I'm going to have to do a PAL conversion. Like, it's a bit of a nightmare to get it to work in North America. But maybe I should instead look at replacement power supplies. I hadn't thought of that.
Yep, you can do that. And you can probably find one of the TVs on eBay that has both PAL and NTSC inputs.
I don't want to have another full TV in my little tiny apartment that's filling up with computers and arcade games.
I understand.
I'm going to be so single for so long if I can't start getting more space. Girls come over and go, no. So another TV is not going to help that.
I completely relate. But if you figure out how to make all this work, like I've mentioned a couple times, I have a couple of those Spectrum computers that I'm storing, waiting for the day when I can take the time and money to make them work. And I'm very anxious to, because along with them, I've got a bunch of cassette software, some titles that look really interesting and very European, like soccer, and I want to play it.
Yeah, totally. Me too. It really appeals to me because it's this whole world I don't know anything about. And I'm out here in the, you know, I'm a colonial commoner out here. You know, like I said, God save the Queen. I pronounced Zed correctly. I should use a Spectrum.
And you know about things like kilometers.
Exactly.
So, Paul, what have you got for us? I think that you've got more than one thing. You are the king of eBay, sir. I love your tweets on eBay, and you just find the best stuff.
Yeah, people should follow Paul on eBay because, yeah, it's just for the shopping tips alone.
Thanks. Yeah, as far as the eBay pick for today, I think I actually have just one. I saw the episode number and thought, all right, well, it has to be a Commodore thing.
Yes.
And of course, there are many Commodore 64s in varying state of repair and varying states of, the demand for the money in return. But one thing that kind of jumped out at me was the Incredible Music Keyboard, which is a keyboard overlay that you can get for your Commodore 64. And you put it over the keyboard and it gives you these piano keys, which I guess must depress the actual keys at the top. It looks very strange. However, I did notice that after having picked this, it's featured right in one of the pictures and several of the pictures from the computer carol that we talked about earlier. So if you want to see one of these in action, you can actually see it on one of the Commodore 64s in that as well. Does not come with software. I have no idea. The little sticker on it says that it does, which means you have to find it if you get this. But it seemed weird enough. Might give you something to do, Christmas morn.
Very nice. So I'll move on to my macro assembler, because I love assembling. I love macroing. I love doing that stuff. So this eBay pick that I've got will let me do all that on an Atari 800. It is a new in-box Atari 800 Macro Assembler and Program Text Editor. New. And I'm also going to say that the price on this so far, let me see if there's any bids on it yet. Nope, no bids yet. So $9.95. Actually, ironically, the shipping to me is more expensive than the product itself.
That happens to me a lot. I'm in Canada.
Now, so here's something. I think that because they're just so darn much fun, a lot of games get preserved, and even some of the top games in new or in reasonably preserved condition go for incredible amounts. Like, what was that one game that we were tracking from a couple episodes ago that I saw a tweet? It ended up going for more than $300. And that's actually kind of middle of the road for some of the super well-preserved games. What do some of those Infocom games go for if they've got all of the goods with
them? Depends on the item, but anywhere from $50 if they're complete, sometimes $40 at the low end. If it's sealed, you're looking at $100 to $250. It's crazy. And if it's one of the particularly rare ones, like if it's a sealed saucer, it'll be $1,000. Like, it's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. So see,
wrong.
Here, if your enthusiasm tends toward the programming end and not toward the gaming end, $10, new in box. So if you really want to program in assembly language on an Atari 800 or some of the other systems, you're probably going to go find one of the really neat, cool cross-assembler environments that we've got on modern computers these days, and they've got everything but the kitchen sink and make it really easy for you. But if you want to program like you did back in the day, then you want something like this. You want to open it up and smell that 80s smell and get to working on that 6502 assembly code. So that's my pick. And, you know, the fact that it's new in the box means it's new in the box, baby. I don't guarantee that the disk will work after all these years, but I'm sure you could find the program out there if the
and
disk didn't
so
work.
Fun to open stuff.
It is. Yeah, it's like love you it. Walked into the computer store in the 80s all over again. So that's our eBay stuff. Now, the part you've all been waiting for. We have a prize giveaway. Tell him what he's won, Johnny. So for today's giveaway, we have Sophistication and Simplicity, The Life and Times of the Apple II Computer, a wondrous book on the history of the Apple II, written by our own Dr. Steve, who will be joining us soon on this podcast as one of the members of the roundtable. We will have a link up for the book, but I can tell you that this book has been painstakingly researched over a period of not months, but years and years and years by the guy who literally wrote the book on Apple II history. He has had forever the website that he has on Apple II history, and now he has taken all of this research and has put it in a book for you, the reader, and your reading pleasure. So, have either one of you guys seen this book yet?
I've got it in my hands at the moment. It came, and my Amazon pre-order had said, like, when it was ready to ship, that I can expect to receive it around mid of January. I'm like, what? And then it arrived, like, a week ago. And I was like, oh, hey, look, it's here. It's awesome. I love it. I'm working my way through it, and I'm delighted with it. Crazily good quality.
Awesome.
Yeah, it looks, it's a real book.
Yeah.
It looks great. I haven't not gotten all that far into it yet, but, you know, that's what the holidays are for.
Yeah. What I'm particularly impressed with, though, is the quality of the actual book, like leaving aside the content, which is itself obviously awesome. And we all knew that anyway, but the actual like physical book is really well made. Like it's great type stuff. I love the paper. I love the binding. It's got a great dust jacket. Like, it's actually a really nice book, like, because he's gone to a real publisher and it's not been knocked out by some really low-rent self-publishing thing, which is honestly the way I would have gone. And instead, I mean, this is just something really nice. Like, as a collectible thing, it's actually really high quality. I'm really pleased with it.
And with that rousing endorsement, I want to tell you that one of these might be yours for the low, low cost of nothing, including shipping. But you have to do something in order to get this. You can't just wish for it. You have to be a part of our contest. And I'm going to tell you how to do that right now. I have four trivia questions plus a bonus question. That bonus question can be swapped for any of the other four questions. If you look at one of the four questions and you go, oh, I'll never find the answer to that, you can instead use the bonus question in exchange for one of questions 1 through 4.
Nice.
You have to send your answers to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. Your answers must be correct. that is one of the things that I will
say. What if nobody gets it correct? Is the person who's most correct wins?
Then Dr. Steve gives it to me. That's easy.
I like it. Okay, that's how it works. Got it. Okay, so somebody out there get them right.
That's right. Somebody get it right. Here are the questions, which, Carrington, let me put you on the spot and ask, can you also have these questions up on our website?
Yep, they will be up on the website. If you go and look at the show notes for this episode, I will ensure that they are there. So you'll be able to read them, and there'll be a link to click to just submit the email, so I'll make it really, really easy. Just go to rcrpodcast.com, and you'll be able to just click and enter.
Beautiful. And again, you got to get the answers right. You got to send us the email to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and we will pick at random one of the correct entries that come in. Here are the four questions. Number one, I wish I had some great music for this, like the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire kind of music. Number one, besides the Apple One, what other product sold by Apple in the early days was available as a bare motherboard? Question two, what secret code did Microsoft embed in the Apple II Plus? Number three, how many high-res colors could an original Apple II display? And number four, what is the maximum amount of RAM that was supported by Apple in the Apple II GS? Send us your answers to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
I'm embarrassed to say I think I couldn't answer them all. There's at least one I know that I don't know, and there's another one I'm not sure about. So even with the bonus question, I think I'd have to Google.
Well,
I won't judge our users, our listeners, if you cheat, because I think I'd have to. But I've got the book. I can look it up in the book.
Yeah, nobody said that you had to answer these off the top of your head.
Okay, good.
We just want the right answers. It's like, think of it as an internet scavenger hunt.
Nice.
You gotta come up with the answers for these things. And not only will that give you a chance to win the book, but it will enrich your knowledge of Apple II history. And let's face it, that's what we're all about, baby. So, with that, I will cycle around to our closing statements. I will kick off by saying, for those whose families celebrate Christmas, a very merry one to you. Also, a wondrous holiday season and happy 2014. We won't see you again until next year, so a very happy new year. Same retro time, same retro channel. We'll be back to harass you some more in January.
Mm-hmm.
Carrington, what have you got as a parting shot?
A couple of quick newsy type things that have nothing to do with me, but they were originally my choices for news, and I thought they were really cool. But then last minute, right before we started recording, I switched what I was picking. So I'm just going to throw them out there so I can mention them, only so that I can put the links in the show notes if people are interested. The first is great write-up on Catcher.com about taking a Mac Plus and getting it on the web. And it goes through all the processes he went through to get a Mac Plus so you can open up a web browser and surf the web on a vintage original Mac Plus. So everything involved in the connectors, the software you needed, all of that. And a lot of people might be interested in doing the same sort of thing with a super old Mac, and this will kind of walk you through it step by step with photos. Thought that was fantastic. And also, I got a real kick out of a link in the New York Times. There was a write-up that just at the beginning of December about a U.S. federal agency that is still on floppy disks and that your government is still using floppy.
Nice.
And it made me laugh. Your government's going to kill us all. So that made me laugh. But for me, personally, I'm just looking forward to some time off over the holiday. I have been working on an Apple II text adventure game that's starting to finally come together a little bit. My parser seems to be working well enough. I keep making my parser, in a sense, worse and worse and worse because I need more and more RAM available. But I have kept the original parser code. And so I've decided definitely when I release the game, I will also release the source code. And I will release, here's the better parser that I didn't have space for in the RAM. But if you wanted to target something that was a better, I'm targeting a standard unenhanced Apple II with 48K as my deployment machine. That's what I want the game to run on. But if you want to give more elbow room, I've got sort of a better parser. Because it was something that took a long time to figure out how to write a decent parser. So I thought people might be interested in reading the code. So I'm gonna work on that a lot over the holiday. I cannot wait. So that's what's up with me.
You are the man. And Carrington,
I'm one of the men.
Happy New Year to you, my friend.
Well, thank you. And Merry Christmas to everybody. I am a big heathen atheist, but I still love Christmas. There's trees and gifts and family time, and I totally love it. Love, love, love it.
Beautiful. Yeah. So, Paul, give us a landing that we can walk away from unscathed.
Ah, that's easy enough. One of the things that I've been I've been sort of recently kind of interested, becoming reinvigorated, I guess, in my interest of the Apple III. So I've been sort of poking around with what I can do with that. I mentioned that I've got the CFFA 3000 in there. I've actually had that card sitting in that machine for probably 6 months or something, but I finally am now setting it up and actually starting to use it. Also, I was thinking a bit about its future and the notorious problems with power supplies that they have, and was exploring a little bit how, to what extent it might be possible to actually use a modern, you know, ATX type supply on an old machine, because it seems like ultimately, you know, I'm all for authenticity and all that stuff, but my loyalty is not with the power supply. Sure. It's fine with me if I plug in an ATX power supply. From what I understand, they are missing, they're missing the minus 5 volt rail or whatever. They're missing one of the things that they used in the olden days, you know. So one of the tricks is to actually find some way to convert I think you have plus and minus 12 and plus 5 volts available into those three plus a minus 5. And so I've been looking around a little bit. There's someone who, part of what sparked my interest in this, I guess, is someone was selling on eBay a reconditioned power supply for the Apple III, and actually for quite a lot, but I was curious to see kind of how he did it and what it might require. It doesn't seem like it requires very much. I think you need some little thing to sort of like step down the minus 12 to minus 5 safely. And things are small enough now that they could be able to fit where the old power supplies were. So that's kind of, I'm sort of exploring that. Hopefully I will live to see the next podcast.
I was just thinking that. Actually, I was just thinking that my loyalty is not with the power supply, the Paul Hagstrom story. It just makes a big title.
Or, you know, a headstone. Yeah. One hand behind the back, remember, right, when you're writing with those PBs. Very nice. Because, yes, the power supplies in these things aren't going to last forever. And, you know, I'm with you, Paul. If that's not authentic, I'm not going to cry bitter tears over that. Very cool. So the final closing, that's it for this show. What a fun one. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. That is our home base on that landscape known as the internet. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. What a wonderful place to go discuss all things retro computing. You can follow us on Twitter at RCR Podcast. Send feedback and send your entries for the contest to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And if you like us, please write a review on iTunes. That helps get the word out. And until next time, until 2014 and on, retro compute. See you guys.
Bye.